Welcome to Breakfast at Beverley's, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the fascinating world of transport and logistics. Join your host, Beverley Bell CBE, an industry expert and former senior traffic commissioner, as she navigates the highways and byways of the industry. From sunrise to sunset, we're here to accompany you on the road, bringing you insights, advice, and thought-provoking conversations with notable guests in the field. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Breakfast at Beverley's. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Guy Reynolds, Commercial Director to Aquarius IT Limited. Guy is a prominent industry figure and an authority on driver's hours legislation and digital tachograph compliance. As the co-creator of ClockWatcher Instant Analysis software, which is now developed into the next generation product called Elite, and co-founder and a key player in Aquarius's success over the past 20 years, Guy's extensive industry knowledge and expertise has been instrumental in driving the company's innovations and ensuring compliance, not only with government guidelines, but with the legislation itself. I'm really looking forward to talking to Guy today about his life, his experience, his work, and I'm going to grill him on the driver's hours rules and regulations. Thank you. Good morning, Guy. Lovely to see you.
Good morning, Beverley. It's an honour to be here.
Oh, don't be silly. It's an honour. Anyway, we'll stop being nice to each other and we'll have a general chat. So as I say, welcome and thank you for coming. And there's lots of things I want to talk about. But I always start by asking guests, do they eat breakfast? Obviously, we've had breakfast today, a very lovely breakfast. But generally, do you eat breakfast?
Yes, I do.
What do you have?
I will have either a mixed bowl of cereals with nuts and seeds in there.
Cocoa Pops?
Nope. All natural, has to be, no sugars. Or I will have two croissants with sugar-free jam and a cup of coffee.
Oh, right. Okay. And do you get up early?
Not really. I'm awake early, but I don't necessarily get up early.
Do you exercise?
I do.
In the morning?
No. Never in the morning. I'm a slow starter, as most of the people around me would have.
Okay, so in terms of breakfast, do you think it's important that we have breakfast? Do you think it's important we try and maintain a healthy lifestyle?
Absolutely. That's come more to fruition with me over the past few years because I'm diabetic.
Right.
Before everybody else asks what sort of diabetes I have, I've got type 2 diabetes. But more regular eating, small and often, breakfast in the morning, yep, I have to take some tablets in the morning, and part of that routine is to take the tablets and have my breakfast.
Okay, well, we'll talk a little bit later about sort of health and well-being because it's one of the sort of things we like to focus on here, but let's just talk about you for a moment. It's quite difficult to tell from your accent. Can you tell us where you're from, please?
I'm actually from near the centre of Birmingham, a place called Erdington, which is the next district to Spaghetti Junction, which I'm sure that everyone's travelled through at some point.
Are you still in that area?
No, I actually live north of Birmingham now. I live in Staffordshire. I live in a little village called Colton, which is by Rugeley, south of Uttoxeter, south of Stoke.
So let's go back to when you were at school. How would you describe yourself in your own words when you were at school, Guy?
Lazy.
Lazy?
Lazy. I was.
Okay. Are you lazy now?
No. No, absolutely not. I'm always doing something.
So why were you lazy at school and you're not now?
In school, I can, after analysing it over many years, there wasn't enough that was feeding my mind. I was bored at school. 1970s, early 80s, comprehensive school. You know, large classes, not particularly focused, mixed ability classes, nothing wrong with mixed ability classes. There's things that I'm not very good at. But the things that I was interested in, there wasn't enough to feed my mind.
So what were you good at school? What did you enjoy at school?
Maths and computers.
Did they have computers when you were at school, Guy?
Just about. I'm proud to say I would identify as the original computer generation. 1979, I discovered computers. I was very, very lucky that the school, comprehensive school in Birmingham, but just by chance, they actually had a couple of, what are now known as PCs. They had a couple of computers. One was an Apple II. You can Google it. You can find it. And another one is a thing called an RML380Z, which was a school's computer. I'm very, very lucky in the school to have those. And the two teachers there allowed me to absolutely geek out on them. And, yeah.
So you spent your hours whiling away, looking at the computer, working out how they operated.
Every lunchtime, they allowed me to use them at lunchtimes. Before school, after school, during school holidays, one of the teachers actually even brought one of the computers to my house.
Wow.
And allowed me to have it there.
Which shows the importance of good teachers in education.
Absolutely.
Because you probably wouldn't be where you are today if you hadn't had that teacher.
There was a chap called Bob Trigger, and he's one of the, there's a number of people during my life, working career, that you meet certain people and they do things for you.
Yeah, they say there's about seven of them.
That's about right, actually. Yeah,
about seven people in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
That are really important.
And at the time, you didn't think that it was the significance of it. But I've tried to contact him in recent years, but can't find him.
Oh, no, that's nice that you've tried to.
I'd love to speak to him and say, look, this is what I've done.
Thank you. Oh, right. Okay. So we're talking a few decades ago.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
Where a lot of our listeners will remember, but we try to encourage young listeners, and we hope that there will be lots of young listeners who probably won't even begin to comprehend what it was like. Just try and give us a flavour, Guy.
In terms of computers?
In terms of computers, what it was like back in the day, as we would say.
Back in the day, if I roll it forward to 1986, which is when I had my first proper job, and I worked for British Gas. And at the time, I'd done an OND course when that actually meant something back in the day. And
lots of our young listeners won't know what an OND, but it's obviously an educational qualification.
I had the chance to go to university and convert that to a degree. But at the same time, I got offered a job at British Gas in the computer department. I was like, well, that's the job I'm probably going to want if I finished.
So do it now.
I'll do it now. So I took the job. So I'm not degree educated. But I worked in computers worked on computers. One machine would fill the size of a gymnasium, one machine, and you'd have one person sitting at a console with one screen. But it would take a group of, at the time, that was a group of 11 people to operate that machine. That's running around with the big old tapes that you used to see. You see them on the television, back in the day when they'd slowly be clicking around. We had a library of 10,000 tapes, so there'd be runners running around. Oh, it started out as a runner doing that, and very physical thing.
Can I just ask you, there's a film, and I can't remember what it's called, and it's about the ladies at NASA?
Yes.
It's absolutely called Beautiful Something.
A Beautiful... No, not Beautiful...
No, no, not a Beautiful Mind.
No, but I know exactly the
because that's got those massive...
It's exactly that. That's what I worked on. And I loved the physicality of it because you could literally press a button on a keyboard and you would see something happen in the room. You would see tapes moving around on the tape decks, or even the hard drives. So, you all talk about hard drives in your laptops. These hard drives, there would be 11 platters. They would be that deep and that wide. They were that heavy that I used to have to carry two, one on either side, because I couldn't carry one on its own. It was too much.
So what would be the memory capacity of a computer like that? And so how do we put that into context?
So the tapes would be 200 meg. Tapes, of which we were talking earlier on. Well, on a good quality professional camera now, one photo could be up to 40 meg. So you could only get five of those photos on this big, thick tape. The hard drives, I think those were 600 meg. So you'd have 12 platters, 12 plates. And they'd be that wide, but they'd have a glass on top of them. If you press that button, you could go and see the tape, go and see the head physically moving backwards and forwards across the head and see it do something, see it processing. That was very, at the time, it was very cool.
So if we're looking about 40 years ago, if we look 40 years ahead, in terms of progress and innovation, do you see it as a good thing or do you see it as scary?
I think the word progress, I'd cut that bit out of that to start off with, because innovation, change, in my head, is not necessarily progress. So computers have always been very, very, very industrial things to me. I'm not a gamer. It's always been about business solutions, a business problem or a business process, a computer program and a system to aid people. It's not a replacement, but to aid people.
So it's to serve.
To serve.
They're called servers, but it's to serve.
To serve. But the direction that we seem to be going now, certainly with AI, is that it's potentially making decisions on our behalf and thinking for us. And I don't particularly like that. I understand that in terms of medical development and that sort of thing. Yeah, great, industrial. I get it. I understand it. But at a personal level, no. We've got 2 million years of evolution as human beings. And if you look at it over the past 200 years through industrialization, through the digital world, through globalization, yeah, okay. I've lived the past 40 years and I've had a very good career out of it. But the next generation and where it's going, as I see it at the moment, I don't think I'm entirely comfortable with it as it is at the minute.
Okay, so we'll talk about it specifically for the work that you do now. But before we do, obviously you have a lot of staff who work for you who will be, I'd call them a techie. You might call them a geek, but as a term of affection.
It is a term of affection.
Yes, of course it is.
I'm a geek.
Yes, well, we're not being disparaging at all. But you've probably got people in your organisation who are 18, 19, 20 years of age or under 25.
Yep, absolutely.
How do they see the future of the computers? Positively or negatively?
Probably in the same, if I step back to myself when I was that age, probably in the same way, because they're young. They haven't necessarily had the experience of adulthood and all the things that brings, and they don't see the problem with where they're going. They're hungry for it. They want to develop. One of our youngest people in the team at the moment is currently working on a completely new development platform that, be quite honest, he's had to explain it to me as to how he's working and what he's doing.
How old is he?
I think he's 22, 23.
And where do you get these people from? Do they come from university or do you recruit them in a different way?
Actually, not one of our team. So not one of our programming team. None of them have come from university. We've actually had them on apprenticeships.
Right.
So they have been to college, but for whatever reason, 18 to 20, they've come away from the college path or university path, and they've ended up coming through apprenticeships.
Like you, they wanted to get on and do the job. They didn't want to.
I suppose they did, yeah. And some of they're all young men, which are exactly.
Not young women there?
Not in the programming team, but that's not from the point of view that we don't want them, that they're not applying for the jobs. You know, they're not in the apprenticeship schemes. We're open to anybody. We have got a number of ladies in the company.
And I just wonder, because I don't know the figures on, because I know very little about computers, Guy. I just didn't know how many women there are in that industry or that sector.
In years gone by, I would say there was more women in IT in years gone by than there is now.
Well, if you look at that film we were talking about, and I'm hoping somebody's going to Google it and remind me what it's called, but it's they're all women.
Yeah.
Aren't there? There's a lot of black women in there.
Yeah, that's what
and
it's
they
about,
have
yeah.
to, they have to use different toilets,
yeah.
different facilities.
Awful.
Yes. So just going back to this whole issue around the positives and the negatives, any computer system, whether it's 40 years ago or 40 years in advance, can be manipulated by the bad people. One could think of a James Bond film.
Absolutely.
Or all the baddies. But you're talking, I think, maybe about where the system itself starts to think for us.
Yeah.
And that's the scary bit.
It is to me.
Okay. Yeah,
It is to me. At the end of the day, it's a computer program. So you think about the number of things that you've had over the years, a computer program that's had a bug in it. And the bugs need to be fixed. AI is a computer program. So it will go wrong. You could go on ChatGPT, even now, which everybody's heard of. You could ask it to do something cool. And it could get it wrong. Even now, if you push it, it will go wrong. It will improve. It will always improve. But there will still be bugs. It can still go wrong. And if it's making the wrong decisions for us, not a good place to be.
Well, in a way, that's a little bit like autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
But before we come on to that, can I just ask you about how on earth did you get into tachographs, driver's hours rules? In my introduction, I said, I'm going to grill you on the driver's hours rules. I'm not.
That'll go be, for it.
No, that'll be far too boring for anybody. But how did you get in to...
I fell into it. So if we go back, forget before the year 2000. In 2000, myself and my business partner Dave Bailey. Because although you've talked about me, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Dave. We are a yin and yang, and so Dave is just as important to this story as me. We started a company called Aquarius Information Technology Limited.
Oh, that's where IT. Okay. Yeah.
And it was a maths calculation that we were doing. We did some work for some car companies, and I created a distribution algorithm that would predict the availability of cars in a marketplace, and so that you could sales planning and forecasting and transporting them around the world. You know, if you had a car, if the car was built in England and it was finished tomorrow, you could have it the day after. If it was built in England but it was going to be in Australia, then that was a 6-week cycle. So you've always got vehicles at different stages traveling around the world on a boat. Great. Feast or famine type activity. And we'd been looking for something to produce as a piece of packaged software for some time. I was doing a bit of support work for some transport companies, and I was in there one day, and there were some expletives being spoken of over a spreadsheet. And I was literally just happened to be in the room. And I said, "What's that?" He says, "Oh, it's working time directive." What's that?
Oh, a lot of my clients say the same.
We still wonder ourselves sometimes. And I was coming back on the A14 one night, dark winter's night, and I phoned Dave and said, "So, can you just Google working time directive for me? Tell me about it. Might have something here." And that was where we initially started. We very quickly realised that working time directive as a program was sort of mildly interesting, but of no real interest without. We then discovered driver's hours law. It's like, oh, what's this?
And you're talking presumably about the EU driver's hours rules at that stage.
Yeah. And then, absolute fortuitously, digital taco was coming in. Great. That's right up our street. Chip and pin cards, card reader, computer program to read it and decrypt it. Yep, that's us. We'll do that. So the stars aligned on that one. I'd also mentioned somebody else that's famous in our side of the industry in the service to transport. I'll say that we met a chap called Mike Lyle. Actually, we did meet a chap called Mike Lyle, but actually it was Dave who really met Mike Lyle and engaged him in conversation. I didn't. I always admit it. And Mike Lyle was a great friend and a great help to us. So he's another one of those people that you meet. And he pointed us in all the right directions in terms of the EU specs and everything that we needed to know, read.
And he did that completely because he wanted to help?
Yeah, completely decent man. Yeah, very, very decent man. And he's been a great friend to us over the years. So, yeah, that's how I got into driver's hours law. But then what we realised was it's one thing to read a technical specification, a legislation technical specification. it's one thing to read it and think you understand it, but then you have to put some context behind it. That's when we started to realise, yeah, we need to understand more than just the technical programming side of this. We need to understand the implications of what we're doing.
Was anybody else doing it at the time?
There was a couple of other companies, but how we were different. We were the first company that produced a piece of software that you could buy as a software package on a CD. You could read a driver's card with a card reader. And then we also had a portable device that Mike Lyle had produced, which would actually allow you to put a white paper chart on there. It's got a clock underneath.
An analog.
Yeah, and you could read an analog. So it was, we produced the first piece of software that you could do analog, digital, and install it on your own computer and do that. So, yeah.
And the rest is history, as they say.
The rest is history. Transport was a very different place to be back in that, in those days. Bloody computers.
Well, sometimes the sector's, obviously I'm talking very broadly, but sometimes the sector's not always keen to be embracing of change. Still have the situation now when we talk to clients and say, have you thought about a driver's app for defect reporting? And oh, no, we like our pieces of paper.
Yeah. When we started, so that would have been 2005 when we properly started in all of this. When we started, we were quite stunned that transport, certainly in a transport office, in a transport company, how far behind they were. When you consider we'd worked in the car sector when we were doing planning systems, and you know, computers were everywhere and they embraced technology. In a normal transport operation, even in larger companies, nothing was connected. There was a PC sitting on somebody's desk. Yeah, they might have email if you were lucky. But to be using, to actually have their own program to be able to do analysis themselves, look at it and see what was going on, they weren't
kidding. And that was my question, because the sector's quite polarised in some respects. You've got the really big operators, 20% of the operators who operate 80% of the fleet or whatever. We talked about that last night over a rather good dinner.
We did.
It was. But the other part is, you know, the sort of the smaller operators. So it's interesting that you say that's across the board in terms of the size. But can I just ask you about data and about how it's used? Because one of the things we find in our work is that operators go, yeah, I've got a tachograph analysis system. Yeah, yeah, it's marvellous. Yeah, what do you do with it? Well, ask me one on geography, because I'm not really sure what we do with it. Which reports do you run? Not sure. And they don't, they often get overcome with data. They've got too much data. They don't know what to do with it. Mm. How do you make sure that you provide the data they need? Or do a lot of your customers, not just your customers, but customers, all of the other analysis companies, just provide the data and then leave it to the client, the customer, to do what they will with it? Because I'm passionate about making sure that they analyse that data and use it to help their compliance.
So the first thing I'd say is that over the years, our development has all been driven by customer need. It's rare that we sit round a table as a bunch of geeks and go, oh, that would be really great if we did that for the transport industry,
that's,
and they're going to
really
love it.
That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah. So it's listening to customers. Now, don't get me wrong, you listen to customers and you hear things, okay. But when you hear the same thing two or three times, you think, oh, right, okay, that's going up. That's getting moved up our development list.
Yeah.
We've always got a development list like this. And there's some stuff that's been on there. Oh, yeah, it'd be nice to do that one day. But if we hear it enough from a customer that, you know, oh, this is a problem, well, that's a problem. Right, okay, what can we do to facilitate that in our software? But in terms of how we present data to the customer, again, we've learned over the years, we like to say it's never more than two clicks away with our software. Now, it's probably a couple of more clicks these days, because it's, you can generally drill down our information to the nth degree.
Okay.
But the first thing you'll see is red, amber and green. We're all familiar with it, with the traffic light system, and there's a lot of us in the industry who have adopted that sort of thing. Red, amber, green. We're not bothered about what's the green stuff. You want to know about the red and the potential amber. So the way we present it at a very high level, at a snapshot level, you can generally see pretty quickly on the screen, am I legally compliant, yes or no? But then when you click through, then you can start analysing information. 20 years ago, people weren't interested in that.
But do they know how to drill down and get the information they need? Do you offer them training when they buy a package? Do they get training?
Within reason, our training is free. If we're doing multiple repeats with customers, then that's a different issue. But
it's more about the principle.
Yes, but the more effort that we put into the customer to understand, for them to understand the software, well, actually, the better it is for us because it reduces the support overhead in doing it. But it's quite a big package these days because it's not just about TACO analysis.
No, it's not. It's everything else.
It's asset maintenance, it's walk-around checking, etc., and all of that good stuff.
And which is more important, because I'm conscious of time, which is more important, the product or the customer service? And
you customer service every single time. Honestly, customer service.
Well, are you good at that?
I like to think that we are, but really you'd have to talk to the customers.
Good answer, Guy.
But we don't.
Good answer.
We don't generally lose customers. I'm always, well, all of us, it's not just me, the whole team, we're generally more interested about the customers that we lose rather than the ones that we gain. Why have we lost a customer? You know, generally, there can be some good reasons, but you know, why have we lost a customer? We don't lose a customer.
And it's about building long-term relationships, isn't
Absolutely.
It? I mean, that's what we do. We build long-term relationships in the hope that, you know, it is going to be for a number of years, not just, you know, oh, well, what can I get out of them? It's not in any way how we operate, and you sound as if you're the same.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So we've talked about work. We started talking about a bit of health and well-being. So can we go back to that now, just talk about health and well-being? If you had 2 minutes to talk about one particular health issue to our listeners, a lot of whom may be male, may be pale, may be stale, may not be, may all be gorgeous Adonises, what would you say to them?
I'll talk to you about prostate cancer. Can you listen to me?
Yes.
Let me have a chat with you and tell you everything that I know. So my dad had it. That was one of the things that my dad died of. Not multiple issues, but actually not long after my dad passed away, I went and got myself checked out because I was going to the loo a couple of times at night, even in my mid-40s. And it's like, got told I got any large.
Isn't that just an ageing thing?
What, prostate cancer?
No, going to the toilet in the night.
Yes, it can be.
And isn't it very easy for blokes to say, oh, it's just because I'm getting old?
Absolutely. So again, 2 minutes about it. Yep, your prostate gets bigger as you get older. So actually, yeah, you can end up going to the toilet in the night. So I'm not a doctor, but this is what I know. So initially I was told, oh, yeah, I've got an enlarged prostate. Oh, okay, right, but my dad's had cancer. No, everything's all right. We've done a blood test on you. You've got a raised PSA, but you're all right. It's like, yeah, but then if you start looking at scales versus age, it was higher than it should be. Me being the geek that I am, I'm going to go and look at that. So it then got monitored for a number of years and I had a couple of tests. Yes, there was one that was in part of your body that you don't really want messed with, but more than one occasion. No, I didn't enjoy it either time. And eventually I went to see another consultant because it was accelerating. I was getting to the point where I was getting up and going to the loo 4-5 times at night. And I was told just by speaking to the consultant and doing a very quick exam on me, he said, yeah, based on your family history, I'd say even before doing a biopsy, you probably have got cancer. That was right at the start of 2020 and lockdown. So you then sat there with it for 3 or 4 months because there was worse things going on in the world. But anyway, I was told I got cancer in the August. I had it operated on in the September. and I had a complete prostate removal at the age of 54. So first thing I say, wasn't a very nice experience. Recovery wasn't very nice, but it was the right thing to do. No, everything works perfectly because it's a lot different to what it was 25 years ago. It's different, but everything works. Yay. But I'd say to any bloke who wants to listen to me or listen to what I've just said, go and get checked out. If you've got even a hint that there's something wrong, go and get checked out. And when they've checked you out, go back again in another 3 years and get it checked out again. Because if it's caught early, it doesn't need to be a problem. There you go.
Well, no, that's brilliant. Thank you. Because some blokes can be, as can many women, very reticent about getting medical help or going and asking the question. And it's always easy to put it off to another day.
Don't be a bloke about it. Go and get checked out.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that. So I've asked you lots of questions. You are allowed, if you want to, because you've been so polite and kind and nice, if you want to, ask me a question.
I would like to ask you your Beverly Bell. Do you know what an impact you had on the transport industry, bluntly, as a lady chief traffic commissioner for the UK?
You don't at the time. I once had a conversation with you where I think alcohol had been consumed by both of us.
Normally.
And you said, not always normally, and you said I was like Marmite.
Yep.
Which I thought was really interesting. I actually like Marmite. Do you like Marmite?
No, I don't,
you
actually.
Don't, you see,
no,
there
I don't
we go.
Like Marmite.
There we go. But, yeah. So, no, I didn't. I was just doing a job.
Yeah?
I was just doing a job.
Do you think you did it differently?
From?
Your predecessor.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you why, because, and I loved my fellow traffic commissioners from when I first started in 2000. You know, your 2000 and my 2000 look very different. But they were all retired brigadiers, air vice marshals.
Yeah.
They were on pensions. They were in their late 50s. Mm. And so it was just a little job to just give them a bit of extra cash. Mm. So they were never going to try and change the world. They were never going to try and change the system. Mm. Whereas when I came in and I was 40 and Tom McCartney was a retired brigadier, but he was 53 and very young in his approach. Mm. And Philip Brown, who was about 43, we were much more, we're in this for the career. Mm. We're in it to see how we can change it. And now, of course, the commissioners are sort of 12 years of age when they're appointed. I'm joking, but I'm making the point.
But through people like yourself, and I am specifically yourself, but the authorities are much more approachable now than when I started in this industry 20 years ago. And I would put you as part of that, that there was an opening up of conversation with people.
Yes.
You weren't just somebody who just sat there and gave out fines. You were approachable. You could talk. You could debate.
Yes. And we tried very hard. And it wasn't just me. We all tried very hard to do this sort of industry stakeholder engagement. And I got a letter from somebody when I first started saying, you'll be sitting in your ivory tower. Mm. And I thought, no, I'm not. So I invited him for coffee. And I can remember my secretary said, I want to go meet some operators. Mm. I said, oh, Mrs. Bell, Mr. Waterworth would never dream of going and visiting an operator. Mm. I said, well, I am. So it's very different.
But to mention other names, people like Gordon Brown and Gordon MacDonald and his team.
Yes, DVSA.
The DVSA. That's a country mile away.
Yes.
from where it was. Yes. even 10 years ago. Their approachability to be able to speak to them when there's an issue and debate, you know, from the point of view of the information that we're passing back to the customers, to the industry, it is literally, quite literally fantastic. Yes. Now compared to what it used to be.
Well, if only, Guy, we could sort of look forward 45 years and see what it might look like then. Mm. They'd all be driven automatically.
Yeah.
Different world. But I think probably glad I won't be part of it.
I think I'm probably glad I won't be part of it as well.
But it's been a delight to talk to you, as I knew it would. Thank you
very much indeed
for coming over.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's a pleasure.
It's been tremendous to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As we conclude another fascinating journey through the world of transport and logistics, we want to express our sincere appreciation for listening. Your support means the world to us. Keep the conversation going by reaching out on social media with your questions and feedback. We're eager to hear from you and continue exploring together. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and check out our other episodes online. Take care on the roads and see you in the next episode.